Merci. Bon, bienvenue à tous et à toutes. Donc, on va reprendre ce cours de Gabriel Cotillard avec la troisième conférence aujourd'hui, puisqu'il y en a eu deux la dernière fois. Gabi va continuer à nous parler, je pense, de couplage électrophonant en régime de couplage fort, et puis aller progressivement vers des systèmes ayant des corrélations électroniques fortes.
Okay. So, all right. So, thanks very much for coming to my lecture. I'm very excited to be here and have the chance to discuss with all of you this very interesting problem of high temperature superconductivity. So today, as Antoine said, we're going to move from materials where the superconductivity is driven by electron-phonon interaction to the cuprates, where the momentum, the differentiation in momentum space, namely where you have different species which are doing different things, seems to be important for the superconductivity. And one question that I'd like to formulate to you today, by looking both at magnesium diboride and at the cuprates, is to which extent this differentiation of the electrons, why is this differentiation of these electrons in momentum space, different electrons doing different things, occurring in these two high temperature superconducting materials? So that's sort of the common theme of the talk. And as we move from electron-phonon interactions to strongly correlated systems. So just to review briefly what we did last time for the people who were not in this lecture last time, what I was trying to convey is that for the electron-phonon materials and for elemental systems, we really have an almost complete theory of the physics, of the low energy physics of this material. And you don't need to understand the technicalities, just remember the key concepts, which is the concept of Fermi liquid theory, that we start with a Fermi sphere, and we just sort of eliminate all the degrees of freedom except for a very, very narrow shell of electrons around this Fermi sphere. When we eliminate those degrees of freedom, of course, the remaining degrees of freedom change their parameters. They sort of change their effective mass. But we have an effective theory which looks like free electrons with renormalized parameters. And when the interactions are not terribly strong, this construction is fairly rigorous. And it turns out that the only interaction which is important, which is survived, is between electrons with opposite momenta in K-space. That's just basically the Coulomb interactions. And the miracle is that these Coulomb interactions, as we go to low energies, if we start with a repulsive interaction, it gets relatively weaker. And it gets weaker sort of by a logarithmic factor that defines the mu star. So we have some electrons which repel by an interaction, which is in most systems of the order of 0.1 millielectron volts. That's really the only unknown parameter of the theory, this mu star. And all the rest is something that we can actually both compute from first principles or extract experimentally. And that interaction is really the effective interaction mediated by the phonons. And what I did last time in the previous lecture, I spent a little bit of time and derived for you this Migdal-Eliasberg equations, which are two equations, one for phi, which is the anomalous self-energy that describes the pairing, and another one for z, which is really 1 over z. It's what we called in many-body theory the quasiparticle residue, which is tells us how much of a quasiparticle we have when we put an electron. So z is close to 1 in weakly correlated systems, and z gets much bigger. This capital Z gets much bigger than 1, or 1 over z, which is the real residue, gets very small in correlated materials. This lambda is the electron-phonon interaction coupling. Here I wrote it for just if we just have one phone on. So it becomes really attractive at low energies and overcomes the mu star. That gives us the attraction that we need in the BCS theory. And we derive these equations. The only thing I did, which I didn't do in the last lecture, is ask the question, well, what if instead of having just the one band that we discussed last time, we have multiple bands? Because in most materials, there are more than one Fermi surface. And then you can think that basically everything that I did methodically last time carries through. The only thing is that each band, in principle, will have its own pairing amplitude. So I added an index J here to keep track of the various bands in the system. And then basically everything else follows. The Z also depends on the bands. And now when we exchange phonons, that's what was described by this function lambda, is now a matrix rather than just a number and describes the interactions between the bands. But this is basically the equations that we derived last time. And those equations are essentially rigorous equations because they follow from really two assumptions. One is like an assumption that the momentum dependence of the electron-phonon coupling is and of things is not very strong. Now, for the elements, that assumption is strong, is really satisfied. If the assumption is not satisfied, then we have to somehow go back to the graphs that we started from and not do the local approximation. Now notice, Antoine was asking, well, what if there is K dependence? Well, just putting an extra index J, taking care of the fact that we have different bands, is a way of introducing already some momentum dependence on top of this local approximation. We're still doing the local approximation, but we realize that different Fermi surfaces are in different places in K-space, and therefore they're able now to do different things. That was one assumption that said this assumption of the local approximation, which in principle can be removed. And the other assumption was basically this assumption of large N, that we can only that we only consider one graph. And that's really justified by the fact that the thing that plays a role of N is really the width, the number of patches that I have in this low energy shell. And when you're exchanging a phonon, the width of this patch is essentially the Debye frequency, and therefore we have something of the order of omega Debye over EF number of patches here. So the assumption of just retaining just the lower order graph, which is what underlines this set of equations, is really a very, very, very good assumption. So here we're really on very firm footing, and we only have one adjustable parameter, really, which is this mu star, which in principle can also depend on the bands. So that was sort of the theory. And then shortly after this theory was formulated, and in fact together with experiments, people more or less convinced themselves that this is the right theory. And since we will move very shortly to cuprates and to things where there is really no agreement in the community as to what is the right theory, it's worthwhile discussing among ourselves how come people really convince themselves that this really is describing what's going on in the elements. And there are really two reasons why people, or three reasons perhaps, why now there is almost universal agreement, with possibly one exception I can think of working physicists, which I agree that this really describes all the elements. And the reasons are the following. First, as I said, this more or less follows logically from first principles. Like the assumptions that we make to get to this are completely justified. I gave you sort of more like a modern derivation, but in the old days, people really checked the same thing just by doing essentially brute force calculations and seeing that the corrections to this thing for the quantities that we're computing are down by factors of 1 over n or omega debye over EF. So the fact that the theory is rigorous, of course, helps a lot because one knows that one is on very firm footing. But second, it was possible to test the theory directly and compare it first with one element. And that I'll show in a second. It was first done by Led, by Macmillan and Rowell. And third, the same framework, the same set of equations applies to many systems. And people can go and change the elements and change in and verify that as we change the elements, some small features which are predicted in the theory are also observed in the experiment, and one has then firm confidence if you put these three things together that we really know what's going on and that we have pinned the mechanism of superconductivity in the elements. And there is very important the role, historically, the role of tunneling. And last time, I derived for you the expression for the local density of states. And I derived it as a function of I omega. And if you remember, it has this square root of, it's here. This is the local Green's function that I derived last time. And this is very easy to analytically continue. All I need to do is put I omega is equal to E plus I delta. So here I get the square root of E square and phi over Z square. So that's basically the thing that enters in the approach. And it contains this ratio of phi over Z, which is really, as I said, phi times the quasiparticle residue. This is really the gap function, delta. And basically, delta is a function of energy that we have to get by solving this set of equations. And it has features. So, and those features can be tested experimentally because this is a measured quantity. And that's what people did. And this is sort of a result of one of the earlier comparisons. I took this figure from a paper by Calapino, Schrieffer, and Wilkins, which was, in this case, they just took a model calculation for the f of omega, which mimicked what Led does. So this is supposed to be this function alpha square f that I defined last time. And in Led, the phonon spectra has two peaks, one at the longitudinal phonon spectra at 4.4 MeV, and the other one at the optical spectra, which is around 8 MeV. So that's basically what you put as an input to the calculation. The mu star, it's taken to be 0.1. Actually, it's remarkable how for most materials, this value of mu star describes the data well. And then they just turn the crank, they solve the integral equations, and they compute the tunneling density of states, and they normalize to the density of states of the normal metal. And this is the result of the measurements. There is a threshold. There's no density of states below the gap. And then there is a threshold. And then there is, this is what the BCS theory would predict, which has some type of singularity of the form of a square root. And the Migdal-Eliasberg theory is this curve, while the experimental curve is the dashed lines. And you see that this minimum, these features are all in reasonable proximity, even this peak here, are all captured both by the theory and the experiment. And this is opposed to the featureless thing that you would have in the BCS. The BCS is essentially quite universal. Everything is described by a constant attraction. This contains the structure of the attraction, all the wiggles which go inside the forming this glue. And you see that without parameters, one gets something which is reasonably right. And yes?
Okay, without sounding excessively critical, so how many adjustable parameters does the theory really have? I mean, the phonon frequencies are known from experiments.
Mm-hmm.
The spectral weights of the phonons.
Yes, in principle, okay. Yes, yes. So, so, so. Yes. Yes, and that's why I was careful in which I said that basically the and I'm careful because there's a school of thought now which is essentially trying to repeat this program for cuprates and trying to claim that they proved with the same rigor that they proved for elements that they have a mechanism for superconductivity in cuprates. So I was careful. There are three types of thing that people can do, and perhaps we should list them. One is basically model, which is the simplest thing that was done in this paper. So here, you just make a simple model of the phonons, you just sort of guess something, and then try to see how well it works. Then you can be a little bit more experimentally oriented, and then you do what Macmillan did, which is to extract f of omega and mu star from experiment. And then there's the thing which I like.
How do you extract mu
star? Well, you have to, I'll show you in the next transparency, and then we should go back to this discussion because it's very important. And there's a third one which I really like, which is to compute f of omega, alpha square omega, from first principles. That can only be done now. And then compare with the experiment. Okay, so those are slightly different things. And they were all done for the electron phonon problem. Historically, this one was the first, and was theorists and experimentalists working together, they tried to extract, using the experimental data, to learn about the normal state on the presumption that the theory is right. Then there's this paper, which is more in the spirit of proving the theory right, starting with a model and compare with the experiment. And this can only be done now in the 21st century, and we can just get almost everything from experiment and compare. But the point is that this in itself would not convince me. Because as Antoine said, there are parameters. But when you have this, and when you can do it for all the elements, when this, which is the thing that we can do now, then I think it becomes a convincing case. And to me, it's the fact that it's the same theory, the same equations, the same codes, which can be systematically applied to all the elements, which give me some, convince me that in fact this story is correct. And then let's sort of see briefly what is the structure, because Antoine asked basically how do we extract mu star. So what is the structure that enters in these equations? Well, it's the real and the imaginary part of delta, and the dotted line here gives us the imaginary part. Notice that here the imaginary part can perfectly go negative. There's a threshold. We're measuring omega minus delta zero. Delta zero is the gap, is the threshold. And there is a threshold for emitting an excitation, which is the gap plus one phonon. That's the first decay channel that opens here. And then when you have the optical phonon, then you have another decay channel, and the imaginary part of the gap gets larger. And then when you have features in the imaginary part, also the real part has some features, and we see those peaks which correspond to the phonon energies. The phonon energies and the spectrum of the phonons can be measured. The same thing in this Z. Again, there's the threshold for when the particle can emit a phonon. So you have the gap plus the phonon. That's the location of the threshold. And the real part remember the Z has to go to 1 at very large frequencies, and it does. And this is lead, so it's reasonably strongly coupled. So it's around 2.4. That corresponds to a lambda, which is bigger than 1, like 1.5. So is this structure that reflects itself in the tunneling spectra, so you know where the features are supposed to be. You see them in N of omega, like I showed before. And the mu star essentially determines the level of this curve of the real part of delta. Just moving mu star slightly shifts the curve of delta. And from an experiment, one can reasonably well determine these two things. So in the original paper, they do calculations with several values of mu star. They see how it shifts the real part of delta. It makes it more negative. The idea is that when you have repulsion, then the gap function likes to change sign in frequency, so it becomes it becomes a little bit more negative at high frequencies. So that's basically what the solution of the integral equations look like. And basically, it's this type of work which convinced people that we have really the theory of the elements. For me, yes. It does.
My understanding is that when you have the imaginary part that develops, you have the emission, or let's say, of a real photon.
No, but that's when this is an off-diagonal Green's function. What you're used to is when you have just a diagonal Green's function, and then you have positive. This is an off-diagonal Green's function, so the positivity conditions are only obeyed for the physical quantities, not for the off-diagonal elements.
No, I was not questioning the fact that it becomes negative.
Yeah, okay.
I
think that there is something to that effect, in the sense that if you look at the structure of the equations, and I will go back when we discuss D-wave superconductivity, it's convenient sort of for the gap to become positive where the interaction is most attractive, and negative when the interaction is most repulsive. So there is some truth in that.
The screening of the Coulombic gauge and gauge of frequency that
makes
the gap want to change sign.
It shifts that, yes.
I have a question.
Yes.
Yes, that
was the second one. It's the inverse procedure. Yes. Assumes the theory is right, and then uses them to extract parameters and learn about the normal state of the material. Now what we can do now is really start from first principles. So that's what Macmillan did, is not really a real test of the theory. He's assumed that the theory is right and use it to try to learn something. What we do these days is very different from first principle calculations. We can pretty much extract everything, because we can extract the phonon density of states. There's something which is called linear response, which is a bunch of tricks which, unfortunately, I don't have the time to explain, but has an interesting history, how it developed, which allows us to compute directly these matrix elements that we need, these functions g, k, k prime that I had in my previous lecture, and then we can get the alpha square f. So then we can actually work backwards. We can say, okay, we computed everything, then let's see how well this computation agrees for example, the alpha square f that we extract from the data, for example. And this is sort of something very, very early that was done, I think, in the early 70s. I took this from a review by Jules Carbot, and basically shows what happens if you do just lead. And again, the theoretical curves are here. They're much sharper than the experiment because they have some resolution. The experiment is sort of broadened. But you see that the intensities and the peaks appear in the right place. And therefore, when you start doing that for various elements, then you start believing that the theory is actually correct and you have some tool which has predictive power. It has predictive power, but still, I have to say, nobody has yet predicted or designed a superconductor, even when we have the complete theory, and there are really glaring omissions in the things that could have been found and were not found. So perhaps I'm sort of quite optimistic when I said that, okay, these things will start, we will start applying this in the future. On the other hand, I can say with great confidence, I feel having examined the theoretical foundations of this, I believe that the theoretical foundations of this stuff is firm. So it ought to work. And it does work. Now the question is whether we are imaginative enough to apply it in a creative way to find things which are interesting. And that brings me closer to magnesium diboride. I told you that it's important to take in the Migdal-Eliasberg equations diff multiple bands. This is something which was first treated really theoretically rather than motivated by experiments. In the old days, immediately after the BCS theory, people asked themselves, well, what if my Hamiltonian, instead of having just one band, has multiple bands, say, for example, an S band and a D band. And people were thinking about transition metals at a time that they didn't really understand transition metals. They didn't realize that the S and the D bands were really very strongly hybridized. But still, they thought about the problem, and they say, OK, let's just write a BCS Hamiltonian where I have an S band, I have a D band, then I have an attraction within the S band, an attraction within the D band, and then some attraction or repulsion, whatever you like, VSD, between the S band and the D band. Okay? And the people who wrote this paper are all very famous, including Bernd Matthias and Harry Sewell, who invented in particular the condo resonance. So they were smart people thinking about interesting things, and they sort of solved these BCS equations, and essentially the paper is not terribly illuminating in the sense that they just sort of write the equations and they sort of solve them and get curves that look like this. So I would like sort of to give you some flavor of what's the physics which is contained in this Hamiltonian, since this is important for understanding multiple materials. And it's at the crux of all the arguments now in the context of iron nictides. There are many, many materials which have this phenomena that we have different Fermi surfaces with superconductivity. So let me just use the board now. So I forgot how I turn on the light. Which one do I do?
I'll try and see if I can help.
Here, okay, I figured it out. So if you remember in the last lecture, I showed you that instead of thinking about BCS theory, you should just think in terms of spin Hamiltonians. And I told you that you should think of K as a site index, and you should think of the dispersion as essentially a magnetic field. And then you should think of the BCS interaction as essentially a ferromagnetic interaction between the spins. So the superconductivity really corresponded to magnetism of a special kind. The reason why BCS theory was so good is because the interactions were essentially long range. And this was sort of a way of writing the BCS Hamiltonian. And in that language, what we had is a phenomena of canting. That is, in the high temperature phase, the spins will just simply follow the magnetic field. So if we have a magnetic field that looks roughly like this, which is aligning the spins, this is just a dispersion E of K as a function of K, and this is KF, right? So the spins really follow this, and that gives you your Fermi-Dirac distribution, because spin up means that you have an electron, spin down means you have no electron. So then, when we lower the temperature, the spins feel a Coulomb interaction, which means that it's ferromagnetic in the spin language. And therefore, there's no reason for the spins not to cant slightly in the XY plane. So those spins simply cant. They just cant in the direction of, in some direction in the XY plane. So then the order parameter SX, for example, corresponds to superconductivity. And then the effective field that we have is composed of the something indexed in the Z direction and in the X direction. So the magnetic field, which corresponds to the excitation energy, has a component in the K direction, and then it has some component in the X direction, where delta is just V times Sx. That's basically the BCS equations. Good. So now if you understood that, then you understand very, very quickly what's going to happen when we have two-band superconductivity. Why? Well, just like K was a side index, now we have one more index, which is our sublattice. So now in the two-band case, we have two sublattices. Just means that we have to put here an index J, which is the sublattice index for my material. And actually, the interactions can connect the two sublattices. So that's the J and J prime here. So we have a Hamiltonian where we have now what happens in the A sublattice, and we have now what happens in the B sublattice. The B sublattice sees pretty much the same situation. But there's new physics in the sense that we can have a situation, for example, where there's actually no attraction in the second sublattice. So for example, we can get the V22 to be essentially zero and still get superconductivity. Why? Well, if you think of the spin system with long-range interactions, once one guy can't, once one sublattice can't, since there is a cross-coupling, there is a V12, and this is a mean field model, also the other sublattice will cant. Okay? So here we're going to have the canting of the second sublattice, even when there's no attraction in the second band. The other thing that can happen is we may have a situation that people, Mazin, for example, advocates for the nictides, where there's essentially no attraction in either band. So V11 and V22 is zero, but V12 is different from zero. Okay? In this case, we can also understand what will happen, and is that since we have a long-range mean field model, remember the K and K prime run over many, many, many sites, there's no reason why these two sublattices would not coordinate and cant by themselves due to the coupling between the two sublattices rather than because of the interaction among themselves. So all that physics is obvious just by thinking about the spin model. The other thing which is pretty obvious is that the internal fields now also will depend on which sublattice you are. And you remember the spin really corresponds to the size of the spin is the energy cost for creating a particle hole excitation. So the and this gives us the excitation energy. So now the two sublattices will have very, very different gaps. It will cost us a very different amount of energy to flip spins in the A and the B sublattice. And now if we go back to the superconducting language, that means that the two Fermi surfaces in principle can have very different gaps. Last but not least, you remember I discussed that once you order in the XY plane, you can have very, very slow modes which describes the oscillations of those spins. That's what's called the sound mode in the superfluid, and it's not observable in superconductors because of the long-range Coulomb interactions. But now we have two different sublattices. So now we can think of spin waves in which the sublattices oscillate out of phase. And that mode is physical, because that mode does not change the charge of the system. So in a two-band superconductor, there's a new physical mode that corresponds to the out-of-phase spin waves of the two sublattices, which, in principle, has finite energy, because these two phases are locked by the V12, but in principle, it can be excited. And that's something that was first discussed by Leggett, and maybe it's called the Leggett mode. But again, in the spin system, we can understand in a very, very simple way all the physics that we expect out of this model. And now I'll go back to the lecture. So for example, in this paper, what the situation that they considered is a situation where the coupling between the S and the D band is actually very weak. If the two sublattices are decoupled, of course, we would have two transitions, because each sublattice would undergo a transition. But if you turn on the coupling, there can be only one transition. But the shape of the gap versus temperature is going to be strange, because at the beginning, basically, the gap on one sublattice is almost zero. And then it's only below the would-be second transition that it gets turned on. OK, so I tried to give you a quick flavor of why this is not just putting one more index. It gives rise to interesting physics. And why this can be understood in terms of the quasi-spin model, which I introduced before. But I would not have done that if it wasn't because this actually was actually seen and was realized experimentally many years after Sewell wrote that paper. And again, this was not a theoretical discovery. It was an experimental discovery, and it had a very, very strange history, and that title, Better Late Than Never, I took from this article by Paul Canfield in Physics Today. And the reason why they say never late than never is because the specific heat data for this material had been measured down to very, very low temperatures in the 50s. But at that time, they didn't graph things. They produced things in tables. And unfortunately, the distance between the points was not sufficiently close to be able to spot the transition. But it was quite clear by looking at the table that this was not really a standard Debye metal. So it took many, many years until Akimitsu was actually studying ferromagnetism and trying to get better magnets, which is another line of research, which looked at this material again, magnesium diboride, and now was in the 20th century. They measured much more carefully, and they could do graphs. And when you do graphs, then you really see much better immediately that there's something interesting happening at 40 Kelvin. And that was superconductivity. Now, another reason why I do believe that for certain classes of materials we have the right theory is because within months that this was discovered, in 2001. So within months, people used this machinery that I described for you, namely calculation of alpha square F, estimation, solution of the Eliasberg equations, blah, 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 blah. And then within months, all the band structure groups that were working in the problem came up with some reasonable picture of what's happening in this material and reasonable numbers to understand the high TC. And then applications followed. And this I took from an article on by Gurevich, who's a specialist in high field and critical currents. And what's plotted here is magnetic field and temperature. And I said in the introduction that the materials currently in use is niobium titanate, because this material
is very malleable, so it's very easy to make wires, or the A15s, so the market was shared between these things. When magnesium diboride came, it opened a new window of things, of fields and temperatures in which it can be used, and therefore was adopted fairly quickly for applications, in this case doped with silicon carbide in order to improve a little bit the critical currents. So that's basically the story of magnesium diboride. But the question is, well, why didn't people think about it before? And why people just followed the question that Henri Alloul asked, the D-metal route? Well, yes. Well, I think that the two gap thing also has something to do with this. But my feeling is that even these things people don't fully understand. Well, it's vortex physics, but just like the high TCs, when the order parameter has structure, it turns out that it's not so good for having very, very, very strong stiffness in magnetic fields. But I don't know how to make this thing precise, but I have a feeling that this is right. I mean, this is a complete area of research. There are thousands of papers trying to, just like we are trying to ask, well, how to improve TC or how does TC work? There's a huge literature on understanding how to pin the vortices, how to get stiffer things. The reason why they had to put silicon carbide is to pin the vortices, and how, whether vortices in with different order parameters, how what is the structure of that? I mean, it's a whole interesting field. All I wanted to remark is that here the progress came quickly because we really understood as a community what we were dealing with. So what were we dealing with? I mean, how does magnesium diboride work? I mean, why didn't people think about it before? Okay, well, let's look. It's made out of magnesium, and magnesium in the periodic table is here. So magnesium is just 2+. The only role of magnesium is just to give electrons. And it gives us to boron. Boron is here, just next to carbon. Okay, so magnesium gives 2 electrons to boron 2. So each boron grabs an electron, okay? So we have essentially sheets of carbon, and if you look at the structure of the material, which I had before, you see that basically we have graphene here. We have layers of carbon with hexagonal coordination, okay? But as Henri pointed out, I mean, carbon is not superconducting. Diamond is not superconducting. Graphene is not superconducting. So what happened here? Well, for that, we need to do an electronic structure calculation. And what we have here is a comparison of the graphene band structure. This is the famous band structure of graphene, where we have this Dirac point, with the real band structure of magnesium diboride. And what I want you to see is that it's pretty much the same, except that it all has been shifted upwards. So what we succeeded in doing is actually dope into the sigma band of graphene. So we took this very, very strong covalent bond. I mean, graphene, you know, has sigma electrons and pi electrons. This famous Dirac physics of graphene that everybody loves is because of the pi electrons, which are essentially at the Fermi level in graphene. And nobody talks about the sigma electrons because they're strongly bound, they're inert. So in magnesium diboride, we managed to turn these covalent bonds into metallic bonds. So that's all that happened in graphene. So now we have 2 types of electrons. We have those pi electrons, and we have those dope sigma electrons, which are forming those strong covalent bonds, and therefore they're strongly coupled to the phonons. And if we look at the Fermi surface, we really see 2 types of Fermi surfaces. You see here these cylinders. These cylinders are the sigma electrons that
are forming hole pockets. You see that from the band structure. And then you see the pi electrons, which are more three-dimensional, which are forming the more three-dimensional Fermi surfaces. And putting magnesium is actually important in the sense that this is taken from a paper by Warren Pickett. As an exercise, they say, well, what if we replace magnesium by just a sheet of doubly charged electrons? Because I said magnesium is double plus. Well, that's not quite good enough to metallize those covalent bonds. You really need the potential of magnesium. The electrons need to feel the magnesium potential in order to move this band further up. It moves the thing up, but not enough. And that's sort of a lesson for people who are thinking how to get graphene to superconduct by interlayering or by manipulating the layers. I mean, chemistry is extremely clever. But after you see that, you understand the story of why magnesium diboride is a high-temperature superconductor. It managed to do something amazing. It managed to get some covalent bonds, which will have very strong electron-phonon coupling, together with these more light electrons, which are not coupled, but are important because they keep the whole structure stable. So that's basically graphene. But plus plus.
They
yes.
found actually superconductivity in calcium dielectric graphite, right? So
yes.
They found that I think around six Kelvin of superconductivity.
Right.
And the mechanism is almost the same.
Sure.
The structure.
Sure.
The calcium intercalates between the layers of graphite, of graphene actually.
I agree with you.
And so you get the same active band structure out of
I agree. I think the idea is clear. Well, all I wanted to say is that the idea is clear. And in principle, one should be able, and it has been done with graphene, but again, one has to think about also about the solid state physics, namely the nature of what you put inside, whether it's lithium, calcium, or what, seems to matter if you really want to move the bands more enough. That's why I sort of mentioned this early paper in which they show that just a metallic sheet doesn't do the job. You need to do more. You need to put some potential in there. And obviously, calcium does the job. And now the challenge for theories, now that the idea is out, is can one actually improve of MgB2 now that we understand how this works? Can we get more than 40 Kelvin? Yes.
But gating has not done the job up to now. That's what you're saying.
Well, chemical gating, as Michele put. Yeah. Again, there's a whole industry now of people who are now gone to this route. I mean, intercalation now is a big thing, and people are studying this problem. To me, the challenge is whether we'll be able to surpass. I mean, now the bar has been raised after this. I mean, now the bar for the theorist is not to explain why this is a high-temperature superconductor, but to design something which beats MgB2, now that we understand how it works. So the basic physics is two very different sets of bands, sigma, which is 2D, pi, which is 3D, two types of electrons, two types of Fermi surfaces, sigma bonds with a huge deformation potential. Deformation potential is how the bands change when you move the atoms. And then I think this is very important. It reminds me of the cuprates. Only a fraction of the electrons are strongly coupled to those phonons. Just like in the cuprates, it's only the antinodal region that becomes superconducting. The nodal region just goes along for the ride. And then, of course, we have the Sewell story with two gaps. So it's a clear case of momentum space differentiation. And again, just to stress again the point, here is the band structure where you see in red, this is pi character, and in black, you see sigma character, and you see the pockets of sigma. Small number of electrons, but very meaningful. They do a lot. It's like the antinodal electrons. And you see here the Fermi surfaces, again, where in this Fermi surface there should be actually a different gap than in this Fermi surface because they feel different interactions. Okay. So now, I mean, this is sort of for just pedagogical purposes, just to how to detect quickly strong electron-phonon coupling. The thing that you can do
is just move the atoms and see how the band structure changes. If you don't want to do this elaborate linear response, if you want to get a feeling for what's going on, and I'll come back to that in my last lecture, just look at what's called the deformation potential. And here you can understand that when you stretch the sigma bond, the bands really look with really move, and that's what's unique. Now, I also wanted to quantify the electron-phonon coupling. What people can do is plot the phonon spectrum multiplied by the width of the phonon spectra that you can measure in neutrons, and then you see only a small fraction of the phonons is very, very strongly coupled. And of course, if you could make more phonons strongly coupled, I think the TC will probably go up. But then you have to do that without destroying the structure. Because the reason why we can only metallize a few number of electrons is because those things were holding the structure together. If we try to metallize more, eventually the thing will become unstable. So there's always a fine line in high temperature superconductivity between increasing the TC and doing something bad for the material. And then here we have the Lyashberg function. This was from the paper of Ole Anderson. And clearly you see that there are really two types of phonons. So, and this has been tested by many, many, many methods, many experimental probes. And I'm not going to give you a full lecture on that because I can spend 2 hours. Now people teach solid-state physics with graphene. I just wanted to get this idea of momentum space differentiation and put the history of this in perspective. But what we have to see really is that there are two gaps. And obviously here the gap will be much larger than in here. So here the gap is 2 millielectron volts. Here the gap is more like 7 millielectron volts. And this is some early photoemission experiment I took by Campuzano, but all groups have actually done graphene and also MGB2. I mean, there's more or less universal agreement that the sigma band has a big gap. This is the sigma band, has about 6.5 MeV, and the pi band, which has 1.5 MeV, just like Harry Sewell envisioned it would happen, okay? That you have very different interactions among the different quasi-spins, and as a result, you have different self-consistent fields. So there's no mystery, but it's nice that we can actually test this theoretically and experimentally, and that we got high-temperature superconductivity from this. So that's basically the story. Point one. Well, okay, that's a good question. Actually, as I said, the lambda JJ prime ought to be a matrix, which means that mu JJ prime also should be a 2x2 matrix. This is something which I said from the outset, theoretically, something which we cannot compute because it's an effective parameter. It's something that comes from integrating out high energies. So we have, that's the only piece of this theory which we're not very good at computing. Fortunately, things don't depend too much on mu star, in the sense that for reasons which I don't fully understand, 99% of the data fits with a mu star of 0.1. So the answer is that this is one of the things which is still really open if we want to close this, how to compute mu star. Oh, yeah. Yes, yes. In this case, people are putting the mu star of 0.1 and having this lambda of 0.8 and getting everything come out correctly. So now I'd like to conclude the part on MGB2 and on superconductivity in general, reminding you that in this quasi-spin analogy, we have different types of excitations in the superconductor. First, we have the flipping of the single spin. That's the particle hole excitations. Those are the Bogoliubov quasi-particles, and they can be imaged directly by ARPES. Then we have this Bogoliubov-Anderson mode. That's the fluctuations in the phase that you see in the superfluids, but no, you don't see in solids because it's pushed up to the plasma frequency. Then you have the fluctuations in the magnitude of the spin. The magnitude of the spin can fluctuate, and therefore there is a collective mode. That's precisely the Higgs boson that people are trying to find at such a great expense. But it was first observed in niobium diselenide, just using Raman scattering. And finally, we have the third form of excitation, which are these out-of-phase oscillations that were first pointed out by Tony Leggett in his very early work. And in magnesium diborite, it's possible that, that this has already been observed via Raman scattering. And this is sort of the paper by the group of Bell Labs, Bloomberg and Miles Klein, where they try to do Raman scattering in MGB2. So let me walk you on what you see in here. So there are two gaps, like you expect, in the sense, okay, so the red curve is the normal state curve. The blue curve is the superconducting curve. And you see that there are two drops. So there are clearly two gaps in this system. And the energy scales of these two gaps agree reasonably well with what people see in photoemission. Now, this is in the E2G symmetry, and that's all you have. Those are different resonant frequencies of the laser for the Raman, so ignore these panels. Just look at this one. So this is in the E2G symmetry, and you can say that everything is understood in terms of exciting Bogoliubov quasiparticles across these two energy gaps. But then when you go to the A1G symmetry, which is fully symmetric, then you see that there's more stuff. And it's this extra stuff that this group suggested is the excitation of the collective mode of Leggett. Notice, however, that this energy is bigger than the energy of the small gap. So this is really a very, very broad mode because it can decay to the particle hole excitations of the small gap quasiparticle. But it's possible that this may be really the Bogoliubov mode, the Leggett mode that was predicted in the 60s. All right, so this is sort of the end of the magnesium diboride. I just would like to sort of end with some historical note before I switch to high-temperature superconductors. And it's in the 80s, that was before I started my PhD, there was really a feeling in the community that the field of TC was not going anywhere. So the review by Phil Allen, which I used to get some aspects of the Eliashberg equation, writes, well, as of January 1982, there has been a maximum of TC at 23 Kelvin for the last 8 years. That represents a normal fluctuation in the steady trend of 3 Kelvin increase per decade that has occurred since 1911. So there's a fairly pessimistic outlook, and still acknowledges that we fully don't understand the theory of TC, because it says, nevertheless, it is clearly dangerous to assert that TC is saturating at the maximum. Two different sensible arguments were advanced in the past to set the limit of TC. Each was later shown to be wrong. Meanwhile, the TC jumped 3 degrees Kelvin. Well, obviously, the TC, even of electron phonon, it was possible to double it without too much effort by looking at the right structure. And again, in the same vein, again, before the discovery of high-temperature superconductors, Vitaly Ginzburg wrote a nice review, which I also used to prepare these lectures, and again indicates that the critical temperature TC of the presently known superconductors do not exceed 24 Kelvin, and he explains why this is so bad, because it's so expensive to cool the material, etc. It is clear that the appearance of easily accessible superconductors, which will need only be cooled by liquid nitrogen, would have significant technological and economic consequences. So, and he insists that until we really have a complete theory of superconductivity, which we still don't, we should not stop as theories, that it's really our duty to fully understand this problem and to say whether high-temperature superconductivity is possible or not possible on theoretical grounds from an understanding of solid-state physics. And what I'm trying to convince you is that with modern tools, that goal is has not been achieved, but it may be now more within reach. So that takes us to now the high temperature superconductors. So this was sort of the line that I covered so far, which ended with MGB2. So we've seen that we can understand more or less this. This is not completely true. We understood the elements. We understand MGB2. We still have some problems here that I may discuss briefly later. But in 1987, something miraculously happened. First, in the 80s, heavy fermions and organics were discovered. Organics at Saclay, heavy fermions at Orsay, heavy fermions at Darmstadt solely. The thing which was remarkable is this jump at the copper oxides, but these are really the precursors. This is something we don't understand. The discovery here by Jerome and by Steglitz just opened a field that we don't understand, because how these materials manage to do that is still one of the subjects that need to be discussed. And there are various questions. Are there some common principles at work? And I'll try to highlight the differences, but also the similarities of these materials. And I call them unconventional because they all share some aspects. For example, the symmetry of the order parameter, in the sense that I defined it in the previous lecture, is not the symmetry of the lattice. Okay, so now a cartoon. By the way, are there any more questions on MGB2 before I plunge in to the cuprates? There were already. By the way, when do? Yes. From photoemission to the extent that I know the ARPES, no. But that doesn't surprise me, because the strongly coupled Fermi surfaces are relatively small, so it's natural that that thing should be uniform. Other questions?
Concerning time?
Yes.
I would personally not mind if you continue till 11:30.
Yeah. Is that okay? Okay. So I will continue then a little bit, introducing and getting to the problem. Okay. So this is for the students in the audience to try to explain that superconductivity from repulsive interactions, it should not be, or for people who are not theoretical specialists, that superconductivity from repulsions is not strange. If we look at the BCS equation that we had before, this V, the reason why we needed to have V attractive is because we insisted that delta has to be uniform and of the same sign. So if delta is uniform, whatever it is, you have it here, you have it there, cancel it out. Here you have a minus sign. If you want to have solutions to these equations, this better be attractive. And to get attraction, we had to work very hard. We had to renormalize this Coulomb interactions. That only occurs at low energies, so we had essentially a phonon mechanism that overcame the Coulomb interactions. The correlated materials just cannot do that. In correlated materials, this V is completely repulsive, so the way that they find their way into the superconducting state is by having delta change sign. Why? Well, let's just take the simple case of the cuprates that is cosine kx minus cosine ky. So you have minus here. I'm plotting this function. It's minus in this part of the zone, plus here, minus here, plus there. And let's again, for example, envision the case that you can only strongly scatter from between points which are connected by pi wave vector. In this case, it would be, for example, going, we have this Cooper pair, and just taking this Cooper pair and move it to a different place by transferring wave vector. For example, move it over there. So if we want to just move this Cooper pair by momentum transfer of pi, then basically we have just a few processes. That would be the processes that connect 1 and 2, 1 and 4, 3 and 4, and since we have here opposite sign of the gap, this function has opposite sign at that one when we're doing these processes. So now that kills the minus sign, and then the V can be positive. So by connecting points where the gap is different sign, the V can stay repulsive. And physically what that means is that now the interaction can be instantaneous. So we can have much larger energy scales. That's why theorists are so excited about the possibility of having much higher critical temperatures, no longer limited by the phonon frequency, from interactions which are strongly repulsive. But of course, we need to arrange the pairs in a much more intelligent way because there's no net attraction. So they have to do something interesting in K-space. So that's correlated superconductivity. And I already told you the main principles. We have non-trivial K-dependence in the gap. Higher energy scales are involved. So that means that Fermi liquid theory may not be the starting point. And what I'll do is I'll just basically take cluster DMFT as a natural generalization of the Migdal-Eliashberg theory as a working tool. And I'll try to identify common features. But I also want to show, in the context of this talk, to finish this talk, some system-specific calculations in the same spirit as the calculations that Macmillan was sort of trying to do, trying to figure out different materials, what lambda they have, trying to organize the materials in some way. And I should admit that we're doing this with very, very primitive tools, and probably more better tools will be needed. And I tend to think of Migdal-Eliashberg theory as this, compared to the problem of weakly correlated materials, and what we have for dealing with strongly correlated electrons is more like something like this. But okay, we'll see what we can do with the tools that we have. And the question that I want to ask is, in the cuprates, what controls the maximum critical temperature? And here I will sort of refer, for all the background material, to the very, very nice lectures by Antoine, where he's already covered all the material that you need in order to have a good background on the cuprates, which I will not give, and understand the problem that I will formulate, which is the problem of the material dependence of TC. Just one background. Until recently, and it was covered very nicely in Antoine's lectures, the dominant thought as to how we can organize the materials, the cuprate materials, was to a very, very insightful paper by Ole Anderson, which noticed that there was a very, very strong correlation between the observed critical temperature and the position of the copper apical oxygen. In the sense that as you pull the apical oxygen away from the plane, the maximum TC in the family seemed to increase. So this is TC max. And the way that they interpret it is by noticing that the oxygen, either in a three-band picture, the oxygen-oxygen overlap, or in a one-band picture, the next to nearest neighbor hopping T prime was the governing factor because it was mediated by the apical oxygen, and it was this quantity, the quantity that correlated with TC. So that's sort of one attempt to try to organize the question, how do we think about the cuprate materials? What governs the TC? How do we make progress in this field? And it's important because according to this picture, if you want to increase TC, you need to increase T prime. Of course, there were theoretical issues with this proposal. First, within all the techniques that I know of, including DMRG for ladders, cluster DMFT for Hubbard models, slave boson mean field theories, it was not possible to substantiate that proposal of Anderson, which is a reason why I never really liked it so much. Even though it organized the space of materials, it was not something which allowed us to really say, okay, we solved high TC because now we solved this model and we can really see that the TC max increases with T prime.
Yes. Co-workers that
Okay, so it was Raimondi and Anderson. I mean, yes. So then, basically, the thing that really convinced me that this story was not completely right is the fact that we tried to really engineer a material, and that's work that was done by a chemist at Rutgers, Martha Greenblatt, tried to really make an isoelectronic analog of the cuprates, that is, reduce nickel enough by putting enough layers so as to just get it close to a D9 state. Our contribution to this paper was actually to evaluate the electronic structure of it, and we got Fermi surfaces which had a T prime much larger than the T prime of any of the cuprates. Unfortunately, no TC. So then we really try to think more carefully as to what's going on.
Three,
yes, but you can say the same thing is in cuprates. You have we have bilayer coupling. There's only the reason why we have these three Fermi surfaces is this material has actually three layers. So just like in BISCO, when you have two layers, you're going to have two Fermi surfaces. This is lanthanum 4, nickel 3. Yeah. So this is really what Phil Hansman and Ole Anderson wanted to do with heterostructure. It was really achieved by chemistry, but it doesn't work. At least maybe the compound is too dirty, there are impurities, etc. But this was not a high temperature superconductor. So then, when I say we, I mean Cedric Weber, Chuck Yee, and Christian Howlett thought about the problem, and we want to make a different proposal on how to think about the cuprates, how to organize the phase space of the cuprates. And of course, the empirical evidence that Ole presented is completely correct. However, the main effect of the distance of the apical oxygen to the plane is to control the charge transfer gap. Moving the apical oxygen away from the plane, what it does, it reduces the charge transfer energy. Why? Because we need to move electrons from oxygen to copper. If you have an extra charge on top of the copper, that gives you an extra penalty for that motion. So it's clear that having that apical oxygen is something which controls the charge transfer gap, and if I move it away to infinity, reduces the charge transfer gap. So it is true, as Anderson pointed out, that moving the apical oxygen also increases TPP prime, which is the overlap, is the jump, the amplitude for hopping across the oxygens via the axial orbital, as Antoine explained in his lectures. But the increase of TPP prime is actually detrimental to TC. So moving the oxygen, the apical oxygen, has an effect. But the way to think about the effect is to separate that effect into two parts, an increase of T prime and a change in the charge transfer energy. Yes? Yes.
Double disorder has a larger effect on the planes when you are in a system where you are missing the apical oxygen. So I am not sure that this is the real situation. Chemistry is violently a problem in this system.
Okay, so let me say basically what's sort of the spirit of this work. And I'm going to show you our evidence. There are many effects that control TC. We know that disorder is bad. We know that the buckling of these planes are bad. All those effects, in principle, have to be taken into account if we want to sort of extract the final answer. And all these things are present in the data. But what we try to do is we try to do just in the same spirit of what I was talking at the beginning for the elements. we took all the cuprates which are available and all the data which is available, and we tried to graph it to look for correlations. If we would try to factor out material by material the effects you're talking about, I'm sure the correlation would become much better. But all we wanted to do is to see a very, very, very gross effect looking from the very, very, very long distance at all the materials in the same spirit as Ole tried to do with his T prime. So what we plot here is essentially we took almost 20 families of cuprates. And basically what we plot here is TC max as a function of the charge transfer energy. And we see that as we reduce the charge transfer energy, as we try to metallize these compounds, the TC max goes up. TPP prime is the jump, the possibility of jumping between these two oxygens. And here's TC max as a function of TPP prime. And just like Ole said, there's also a correlation. Okay, so this correlation is as good as this correlation. But what we believe is that this is the thing which is important for understanding the TC, and this is in fact detrimental to TC. Okay, so that's basically a purely empirical observation. So here all we've done is we're just taking many, many, many compounds and use our LDA plus EMFT to get the starting point of what would be the charge transfer gap to do further calculations. But now we can show causation. Before I show correlation, just like Anderson showed correlation, but now as theorists we can prove causation. Because in theory, I don't have apical oxygens and I can change independently EP minus ED and TPP prime. And we can show that technically, what we do here are low-temperature ED calculations with about 12 sites for the copper-oxygen model. Those are the first time, to my knowledge, Cedric Weber succeeded in extending ED to the case that we are also in the self-consistency condition, oxygen, and copper-oxygen overlap. And then basically what we're plotting is the maximum, the gap, which is a proxy for the TC. We cannot get the TC because we're doing ED. But we believe that the gap at optimal doping is a good proxy for the critical temperature. And we can show, starting from LASCO, we can move independently the TPP prime and decrease the EP minus ED, and show that indeed TPP prime is detrimental, but reducing EP minus ED helps. Okay? So increasing TPP prime hurts TC, but moving the apical oxygen reduces ED minus EP, but also increases TPP prime. We believe that it's this effect which is really dominant. Okay, and one thing which I learned while I was preparing these lectures, I think it sort of might remove another difficulty which was stressed in Antoine's class that last year, that there is a contradiction in some sense between the work that showed that TC increases as the apical oxygens are pulled out with STM work by Seamus Davis, which shows that the gap scale increases as apical oxygens are driven closer to the plane. So the way that we interpret this is that when we move the oxygen closer to the plane, and this is in underdoped materials, when we move the apical oxygen close to the plane, that increases the charge transfer gap. It makes the material slightly more insulating and therefore promotes the pseudo gap. So in my view, this proposal not only accounts for the experiments that the stress experiments on LASCO that shows that basically when you pull away the oxygen, you increase TC max, but can account also for this observation. And then I will just now wrap up. I will skip some things. But I'd like to sort of wrap the lecture. I think that using two theoretical approaches in this lecture, Migdal-Eliasberg theory and cluster DMFT, we examine two aspects of the landscape of superconducting systems. So we have this huge space and we look at two spots, but I think we found interesting stuff. I mean, we found that MGB2 really used two types of phonons, two types of electrons, and managed to get reasonably high transition temperature, even though it's limited by the fact that there's a maximum frequency, which is the phonon frequency. And then we move to cuprates, and we ask also similar questions. What's controlling TC? And we make a proposal that is the charge transfer gap energy. And again, that suggests, is it possible to improve? I find it interesting that the highest TC materials, like the mercury compound, are such that they don't have a parent compound. And I think it's because they are closer to metallization, so there's nothing that is holding them together in the insulating phase. But they exist in the highly doped state, and it could be possible to reduce the charge transfer gap further, perhaps by heterostructuring, by adding a metallic layer to improve the screening. And that should result in an improvement of TC if this direction is actually correct. So that's one thing I wanted to conclude with. And the other thing I wanted to conclude, since I spent the lecture trying to sort of highlight how important is this phenomenon of two gaps. By the way, D-wave superconductivity is an extreme form of two gaps, where the nodal region has basically zero gap and the antinodal region has a large gap. Since the recognition that this is interesting, now people are revisiting old materials. So I took this graph from a paper by Keimer, and I see now that the list of two-gap superconductors has increased a lot, and now materials like vanadium silicide or molybdenum antimonide or the nickel borides are now classified as two-gap superconductors. So I think that maybe this presence of two types of electrons and two gaps maybe is something which is useful for high-temperature superconductivity. So this is a good place to end the lecture. Sorry I took a little bit longer than I should have.